name is David Wee. I have retired as an English professor at St. Olaf College, where I taught for 40 years. And it's fun for me to see scattered around the Holden Village staff and community some of my former students. I've been an English professor, so literature and writing has been my field. My wife is, she and our daughter are the poets in the family. But I try to find new poets and other people introduce them to me. And I have been fascinated just after recent discovery of this I had a hard time with her first name. Miss Wava Zimborska. May she forgive me if that's a little off. She's Polish and born in 1923, so that makes her 87 years old now. And she won the 1996 Nobel Prize in Literature. And for my world, sort of burst on the scene. Others, I'm sure, knew of her before, especially in Europe. But now her poetry has been published and translated from the Polish into many European languages, into Chinese, Japanese, spreading out around the world. And I can understand why. We have this book in the bookstore. View with a Grain of Sand is a collection of her poems. And if you enjoy what she does after an hour, that's the first place you could get it. Otherwise, it's going to be available in your favorite bookstore, wherever that is. I'm not an expert about her. I had only heard of her a few years ago, and someone else said, you got to read this book. So she is not the result of years of my scholarly study or the topic of my dissertation or anything like that. I want you to know that I am treating her or meeting her, encountering her in the way that it may be for some of you as well. Whenever we find a new writer, we don't have to do scholarly research or even read critical books about the writer, and I've read nothing about her from others. But I want to share this poetry with you and see if you like it as well as I do. This will be, unlike many of the classes one teaches in school and college, not something that you have been assigned to read, so I'm understanding that some of you, well, let me ask, how many of you have read her literature? A couple of you, okay. That's fine. Y'all have all the answers for us. So what I picked out about 20 poems from this collection, and I will read them if anyone would like to read one or two yourself for us. Wave your hand and say, let me give it a try. The translators, as far as I can tell, not knowing Polish, have written very good English poetry as they translated her into English. I can't tell exactly how true it is to her idiom. And one always thinks when you're reading work from another language, especially a language that you don't know, so you can't tell whether the translator is being true and accurate to both the words and the spirit and the rhythms and the music of the original. I often think, this is good. I wish I could read it in the original because it would be even better in the language in which she wrote it, and I'm sure it would be. So if you enjoy her work, On the Monday, we listened to the poetry of Billy Collins, who was poet laureate of the United States 10 years ago. There's one poem in here that I'd like to read to us again. I read it Monday night as well. Because it's Billy Collins' take on how do you approach getting the meaning out of a poem? How do you understand what a poem means? And I thought of Billy Collins' words several times as I was reading her poetry. There are lines in there and references that I don't get. Most of them one can, but the few things that are somewhat obscure to me. And as you'll hear, she has a remarkable ability to start over here and start moving, and you don't know where this is going. And all of a sudden, after you've finished and you're done scratching your head, and you maybe read it again, you say, oh, wow, you know, I get it. But you don't, I'm not expecting you, and I, because I haven't done it myself, to sit down and write essays about any of these poems. But this Billy Collins poem from his book, Sailing Alone Around the Room, is entitled Introduction to Poetry. And many of us who have been English teachers at any level in the world have taught courses with that title, Introduction to Poetry, trying to get our students to read with perception and appreciation by being very careful and attentive and so forth. Here's what Billy Collins says, and the them and the they in this poem are, of course, his college students. Introduction to Poetry. I ask them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out. Or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with the hose to find out what it really means. I'm not going to do that or expect that.
What was the name of that book again? Sailing Alone
Around the Room. Last I saw, there was one copy of this available in the Holden Village bookstore. So I'm going to start out with a poem called Poetry Reading. So that's what we're engaging in here. Poetry Reading. And then I'll turn to a couple of the first poems that caught my fascination with her, and then move through all the others that I found especially interesting and not overly long. Most of her poems are just one, maybe two pages long. And I did read this morning that she has published fewer than 300 poems in her lifetime. And she's not one of these who has thousands of poems published.
That's remarkable.
Poetry reading. To be a boxer or not to be there at all. Oh, muse, where are our teeming crowds? 12 people in the room. Well, 13. We're doing better than her image here. 12 people in the room, 8 seats to spare. It's time to start this cultural affair. Half came inside because it started raining. The rest are relatives. Oh, muse. Almost every poet has participated in a poetry reading like this. The women here would love to rant and rave, but that's for boxing. Here they must behave. Dante's Inferno is ringside nowadays. Likewise his paradise. Oh, muse. Oh, not to be a boxer, but a poet. One sentenced to hard shelling for life. For lack of muscles, forced to show the world the sonnet that may make the high school reading lists with luck. Oh, muse. Oh, bobtailed angel Pegasus. In the first row, a sweet old man's soft snore. He dreams his wife's alive again. What's more, she's making him that tart she used to bake. A flame, but carefully, don't burn his cake. We start to read, oh muse. Okay, now, a couple that take us away from the idea of poetry to some of her ideas about the world. And I think you'll find, as I do, and it's really quite remarkable range of topics that she chooses to write about, or fields of interest from which she draws her metaphors and her language. But almost always, underneath it all, is her fairly cynical and hard-headed recognition of where the world has gone wrong and what values we should be embracing. Here's one called The Century's Decline. Our 20th century was going to improve on the others. It will never prove it now, now that its years are numbered, its gait is shaky, its breath is short. Too many things have happened that weren't supposed to happen, and what was supposed to come about has not. Happiness and spring, among other things, were supposed to be getting closer. Fear was expected to leave the mountains and the valleys. Truth was supposed to hit home before a lie. A couple of problems weren't going to come up anymore. Hunger, for example, and war, and so forth. There was going to be respect for helpless people's helplessness. Trust, that kind of stuff. Anyone who planned to enjoy the world is now faced with a hopeless task. Stupidity isn't funny. Wisdom isn't gay. Hope isn't that young girl anymore, etc., alas. God was finally going to believe in a man both good and strong, but good and strong are still two different men. How should we live? Someone asked me in a letter. I had meant to ask him the same question. Again and as ever, as may be seen above, the most pressing questions are naive ones. And how should we live is really what's at the heart of her poetry. And then this one, especially appropriate for students, recent college graduates, and many others in the workforce now. This is called Writing a Resume. Now listen carefully to what she tells us should be and shouldn't be in a resume, and you'll get a sense of how she thinks. Writing a resume. What needs to be done? Fill out the application and enclose the resume. Regardless of the length of life, a resume is best kept short. Concise, well-chosen facts are de rigueur. Landscapes are replaced by addresses. Shaky memories give way to unshakable dates. Of all your loves, mention only the marriage. Of all your children, only those who were born. Who knows you matters more than whom you know. Trips, only if taken abroad. Memberships in what, but without why. Honors, but not how they were earned. Write as if you'd never talked to yourself and always kept yourself at arm's length. Pass over in silence your dogs, cats, birds, dusty keepsakes, friends, and dreams. Price not worth, and title not what's inside. His shoe size, not where he's off to, that one you pass off as yourself. In addition, a photograph with one ear showing. What matters is its shape, not what it hears. What is there to hear anyway? The clatter of paper shredders. You see, she's quite cynical about many things, but you can understand what she considers valuable in a human being by what she says to include, not to include, what is expected and what we provide. Okay, those I found so fascinating that I read more. And as I worked on this presentation and figuring out, you know, what to introduce to you people, as you can see, you know, I marked a lot of poems in here, and I kept reading poems after I'd marked enough and thought, how can I leave that one out? How can I leave that one? So we'll get as many done as we can during our time. I'm gonna read next two love poems with interesting perspectives on love. True love. True love. Is it normal? Is it serious? Is it practical? What does the world get from two people who exist in a world of their own? Placed on the same pedestal for no good reason, drawn randomly from millions, but convinced it had to happen this way. In reward for what? For nothing. The light descends from nowhere. Why on these two and not on others? Doesn't this outrage justice? Yes, it does. Doesn't it disrupt our painstakingly erected principles and cast the moral from the peak? Yes, on both accounts. Look at the happy couple. Couldn't they at least try to hide it? Fake a little depression for their friend's sake? Listen to them laughing. It's an insult. The language they use, deceptively clear. And their little celebrations, rituals, the elaborate mutual routines, it's obviously a plot behind the human race's back. It's hard even to guess how far things might go if people started to follow their example. What could religion and poetry count on? What would be remembered? What renounced? Who'd want to stay within bounds? True love. Is it really necessary? Tact and common sense tell us to pass over it in silence, like a scandal in life's highest circles. Perfectly good children are born without its help. It couldn't populate the planet in a million years, it comes along so rarely. Let the people who never find true love keep saying that there's no such thing. Their faith will make it easier for them to live and die. There's that cynicism. And then this love poem is Love at First Sight. So many of us talk about, it was love at first sight. And she's giving the lie to that belief. They're both convinced that a sudden passion joined them. Such certainty is beautiful, but uncertainty is more beautiful still. Since they'd never met before, they're sure that there'd been nothing between them. what's the word from the streets, staircases, hallways? Perhaps they've passed each other by a million times. I want to ask them if they don't remember a moment face to face in some revolving door. Perhaps a sorry muttered in a crowd. A curt wrong number caught in the receiver. But I know the answer. No, they don't remember. They'd be amazed to hear that chance has been toying with them now for years. Not quite ready yet to become their destiny. It pushed them close, drove them apart, and barred their path, stifling a laugh, and then leaped aside. There were signs and signals, even if they couldn't read them yet. Perhaps 3 years ago, or just last Tuesday, a certain leaf fluttered from one shoulder to another. Something was dropped and then picked up. Who knows, maybe the ball that vanished into childhood's thicket. There were doorknobs and doorbells where one touch had covered another beforehand. Suitcases checked and standing side by side. One night, perhaps the same dream, grown hazy by warning. Every beginning is only a sequel, after all, and the book of events is always open halfway through. So there's a marvelous thought to think of. You know, how many times before you thought you first met your true love, or you're going to meet your true love, it might already have happened that you had met and encountered each other and you don't even know it. The book of events is already halfway through and we meet each other in chapter 14. So,
do you know if she was married?
Yes, I think for 6 years. And maybe she has been married again, I don't know. Now here, listen to some of the other things you might not expect from this person, this Nobel laureate in literature. This political activist, but at times housewife in Krakow, Poland. Here's a 12-line poem entitled Bodybuilder's Contest. From scalp to sole, all muscles in slow motion, the ocean of his torso drips with lotion. The king of all is he who preens and wrestles with sinews twisted into monstrous pretzels. On stage, he grapples with a grizzly bear, the deadlier for not really being there. Three unseen panthers are in turn laid low, each with one smoothly choreographed blow. Can you see this bodybuilder is around up there? He grunts while showing his poses and paces. His back alone has 20 different faces. The mammoth fist he raises as he wins is tribute to the force of vitamins. Now, that's a very carefully rhymed translation. I don't know if it is in Polish as well, but you know, the fact that the translators were able to get those rhymed couplets to work, I think is remarkable. Here's one called The Classic. See if you can figure out what the classic what is in here. A few clods of dirt and his life will be forgotten. The music will break free from circumstance. No more coughing of the maestro over minuets. Poultices will be torn off. Fire will consume the dusty, lice-ridden wig. Ink spots will vanish from the lace cuff. The shoes, inconvenient witnesses, will be tossed on the trash heap. The least gifted of his pupils will get the violin. Butcher's bills will be removed from between the music sheets. His poor mother's letters will line the stomachs of mice. The ill-fated love will fade away. eyes will stop shedding tears. The neighbor's daughter will find a use for the pink ribbon. The age, thank God, isn't romantic yet. Everything that's not a quartet will become a forgettable fifth. Everything that's not a quintet will become a superfluous sixth. Everything that's not a choir made of 40 angels will fall silent, reduced to barking dogs, a gendarme's belch. The aloe plant will be taken from the window along with a dish of fly poison and a pomade pot. And the view of the garden, oh yes, will be revealed, the garden that was never here. Now hark ye mortals, listen, listen now. Take heed in rapt amazement. O rapt, O stunned, O heedful mortals, listen. O listeners, now listen, be all ears. Apparently a poem about mortality, about what happens after we're gone, especially great artists, perhaps. And it's difficult to live with some of those possibilities. And you'll notice in several of her poems, she writes whole catalogs of things. There'll be, in the poem I just read, every one of those assertions was one line, period, at the end. And she sometimes makes long lists of things that we have to ponder without drawing the logical or illogical connections between them. We have to pray for themselves. This is entitled Under One Small Star. My apologies to chance for calling it necessity. My apologies to necessity if I'm mistaken after all. Please don't be angry, happiness, that I take you as my due. May my dead be patient with the way my memories fade. My apologies to time for all the world I overlook each second. My apologies to past loves for thinking that the latest is the first. Forgive me, distant wars, for bringing flowers home. Forgive me, open wounds, for pricking my finger. I apologize for my record of minuets to those who cry from the depths. I apologize to those who wait in railway stations for being asleep today at 5 a.m. Pardon me, hounded hope, for laughing from time to time. Pardon me, deserts, that I don't rush to you bearing a spoonful of water. And you, falcon, unchanging year after year, always in the same cage, your gaze always fixed on the same point in space. Forgive me, even if it turns out you were stuffed. My apologies to the felled tree for the table's four legs. My apologies to great questions for small answers. Truth, please don't pay me much attention. Dignity, please be magnanimous. Bear with me, O mystery of existence, as I pluck the occasional thread from your train. Soul, don't take offense that I've only got you now and then. My apologies to everything, that I can't be everywhere at once. My apologies to everyone, that I can't be each woman and each man. I know I won't be justified as long as I live, since I myself stand in my own way. Don't bear me ill will, speech, that I borrow weighty words, then labor heavily so that they may seem light. Now, this is a humbling poem, you know, trying to take account for life and having to give apologies to all sorts of abstract objects and concrete objects for things that we couldn't possibly have done anyway, but also for the little failures that are part of our everyday life. Here's another catalog poem, really short. clothes. You take off, we take off, they take off. Coats, jackets, blouses, double-breasted suits made of wool, cotton, cotton polyester, skirts, shirts, underwear, slacks, slips, socks, putting, hanging, tossing them across the backs of chairs, the wings of metal screens. For now, the doctor says it's not too bad. You may get dressed, get rested up, get out of town, take one in case at bedtime, after lunch, show up in a couple of months, next spring, next year, you see. And you thought, and we were afraid that, and he imagined, and you all believed. It's time to tie, to fasten with shaking hands, shoelaces, buckles, Velcro, zippers, snaps, belts, buttons, cufflinks, collars, neckties, clasps, and to pull out of handbags, pockets, sleeves, a crumpled, dotted, flowered, checkered scarf whose usefulness has suddenly been prolonged. I'd love to hear this one in the Polish. You know, look, those catalogs of pieces of clothing, what the Polish words might mean for them. Here it is. An opinion on the question of pornography. Now pay careful attention to this one, because you learn from the first line what she considers pornographic. And then listen to the language in which she describes the pornographic behaviors that make it up. An opinion on the question of pornography. There's nothing more debauched than thinking. This sort of wantonness runs wild like a wind-borne weed in a plot laid out for daisies. Nothing's sacred for those who think. Calling things brazenly by name, risque analyses, salacious syntheses, frenzied, rakish chases after the bare facts, the filthy fingering of touchy subjects, discussion in heat. It's music to their ears. In broad daylight, or under cover of night, they form circles, triangles, or pairs. The partner's age or sex are unimportant. Their eyes glitter, their cheeks are flushed. Friend leads friend astray. Degenerate daughters corrupt their fathers. A brother pimps for his little sister. They prefer the fruits from the forbidden tree of knowledge to the pink buttocks found in glossy magazines. All that ultimately simple-hearted smut. The books they relish have no pictures. What variety they have lies in certain phrases marked with a thumbnail or a crayon. It's shocking, the positions, the unchecked simplicity with which one mind contrives to fertilize another. Such positions the Kama Sutra itself doesn't know. During these trysts of theirs, the only thing that's steamy is the tea. People sit on their chairs and move their lips. Everyone crosses only his own legs, so that one foot is resting on the floor, while the other dangles freely in midair. Only now and then does somebody get up, go to the window, and through a crack in the curtains, take a peep out at the street. Interesting extended metaphor and set of language choices to talk about the excesses of pure thinking or academic thinking, perhaps you might put it, and having to peek outside to see the real world from these little trysts, as she calls them. Again, quite cynical, you know, this seems to be an anti-intellectual poem, but she is causing us to think very hard about what our kind of fanaticisms, shapes they take. And sometimes they are self-thinking. Here's one, Into the Ark, the biblical poem. An endless rain is just beginning. Into the ark, for where else can you go? You poems for a single voice, private exaltations, unnecessary talents, surplus curiosity, short-range sorrows and fears, eagerness to see things from all six sides. Rivers are swelling and bursting their banks. Into the ark, all you chiaroscuros and halftones, you details, ornaments and whims, silly exceptions, forgotten signs, countless shades of the color gray, play for play's sake, and tears of mirth. As far as the eye can see, there's water and hazy horizon. Into the ark, plans for the distant future, joy, indifference, admiration for the better man, choice not narrowed down to one of two, outworn scruples, time to think it over, and the belief that all this will still come in handy someday. For the sake of the children that we still are, fairy tales have happy endings. That's the only finale that we'll do here, too. The rain will stop, the waves will subside, the clouds will part in the cleared up sky, and they'll be once more what clouds overhead ought to be, lofty and rather lighthearted in their likeness to things drying in the sun, isles of bliss, lambs, cauliflowers, diapers. Things that she thinks need to be saved. Into the ark you go. Not the same list all of us would have thought of. Here's one called No Title Required. It has come to this. I'm sitting under a tree beside a river on a sunny morning. It's an insignificant event and won't go down in history. It's not battles and pacts where motives are scrutinized or noteworthy tyrannicides. Sounds like a morning on Railroad Creek in Old Village. And yet I'm sitting by this river. That's a fact. And since I'm here, I must have come from somewhere. And before that, I must have turned up in many other places, exactly like the conquerors of nations before setting sail. Even a passing moment has its fertile past. It's Friday before Saturday. It's May before June. Its horizons are no less real than those that a marshal's field glasses might scan. This tree is a poplar that's been rooted here for years. The river is the Rabba. It didn't spring up yesterday. The path leading through the bushes wasn't beaten last week. The wind had to blow the clouds here before it could blow them away. And though nothing much is going on nearby, the world is no poorer in details for that. It's just as grounded, just as definite, as when migrating races held it captive. Conspiracies aren't the only things shrouded in silence. Retinues of reasons don't trail coronations alone. Anniversaries of revolutions may roll around, but so do oval pebbles encircling the bay. The tapestry of circumstance is intricate and dense. Ants stitching in the grass sewn into the ground, the pattern of a wave being needled by a twig. So it happens that I am, and look. Above me, a white butterfly is fluttering through the air on wings that are its alone, and a shadow skims through my hands that is none other than itself, no one else's but its own. When I see such things, I'm no longer sure that what's important is more important than what's not. Simple details of what's around us, out by the creek, maybe just as important as great things that the historians write about. A few more. this one, and I'm not sure I really understand what has happened after reading it several times, maybe you'll figure it out. It's called Cat in an Empty Apartment. Know
Sorry.
This one?
Nope.
Okay.
My pillow fell.
Your pillow fell, okay. There are more up there.
Yeah, that's fine. Sorry about that.
And the voice is apparently the cat's voice here. Die. You can't do that to a cat. Since what can a cat do in an empty apartment? Climb the walls? Rub up against furniture? Nothing seems different here, but nothing is the same. Nothing has been moved, but there's more space. And at nighttime, no lamps are lit. Footsteps on the staircase, but they're new ones. The hand that puts fish on the saucer has changed, too. Something doesn't start at its usual time. Something doesn't happen as it should. Someone was always, always here, then suddenly disappeared, and stubbornly stays disappeared. Every closet has been examined. Every shelf has been explored. Excavations under the carpet turn up nothing. A commandment was even broken. Papers scattered everywhere. What remains to be done? Just sleep and wait. Just wait till he turns up. Just let him show his face. Will he ever get a lesson on what not to do to a cat? Sidle toward him as if unwilling, and ever so slow, on visibly offended paws, and no leaps or squeals, at least to start.
So she's just answered the Martha, as in
the
cat.
Yeah.
I mean, she's... The cat has been left at home.
Sounds like it has
waiting
been abandoned.
For somebody, yeah. Waiting for somebody who probably won't return.
Yeah, I think that's right. But the cat will be vengeful if
so
he ever does.
Whoever comes to the door
comes
to get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing's a Gift is the name of this one. And I think I'll read just a couple more here. Nothing's a gift. It's all on loan. I'm drowning in debts up to my ears. I'll have to pay for myself with myself. Give up my life for my life. Here's how it's arranged. The heart can be repossessed, the liver too, and each single finger and toe. Too late to tear up the terms. My debts will be repaid, and I'll be fleeced, or more precisely, flayed. I move about the planet in a crush of other debtors. Some are saddled with the burden of paying off their wings. Others must willy-nilly account for every leaf. Every tissue in us lies on the debit side. Not a tentacle or tendril is for keeps. The inventory, infinitely detailed, implies we'll be left not just empty-handed, but handless, too. I can't remember where, when, and why I let someone open this account in my name. We call the protest against this the soul, and it's the only item not included on the list. It's fascinating how you, the realistic details and the fantastic details and such get mixed up together, but ultimately at the end we can see what she believes crushes the soul. And that's most of what we do in the way we live in debt to all sorts of things. And then here's the last one in the book. We're extremely fortunate not to know precisely the kind of world we live in. One would have to live a long, long time, unquestionably longer than the world itself. Get to know other worlds, if only for comparison. Rise above the flesh, which only really knows How to Obstruct and Make Trouble. For the sake of research, the big picture, and definitive conclusions, one would have to transcend time in which everything scurries and whirls. From that perspective, one might as well bid farewell to incidents and details. The counting of weekdays would inevitably seem to be a senseless activity. Dropping letters in the mailbox, a whim of foolish youth. The sign, "No walking on the grass," a symptom of lunacy. Seems to me, even though she lives over there in Poland, sounds like she's writing about us with these details, or maybe it's the translators that have, you know, effectively used images that are more common in our hemisphere. But she seems to be in almost every poem telling us how we should live, telling us what is crushing to the soul, telling us that war and pomp and circumstance and all these other things are not nearly as important as the unimportant things, like sitting by Railroad Creek in the morning and tossing a few pebbles in. Well, do you have, well, I could read tons more of these, but do you have any reactions to this that you'd like to share? Because some of you may find it really obscure and strange. It's been hard for me to put into words, too. You know, what is she doing to me with these poems? And I'm finding myself being embarrassed about how I live when I read these and when I look at my culture and see the ways in which all the things we care about are really unimportant. Many of the things we care about are unimportant objects instead of integrity and honesty and character and all the rest.
She's writing about the human condition, and the human condition is what it is everywhere, with
That's
all
right.
in all walks of life.
That's right.
So you can relate to the things that she says, regardless of where you live.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's fun to think of the details that are uniquely Polish that perhaps had to be translated into parallels that are uniquely English language details.
There were times I'd love to see them as you're talking or reading them, because I couldn't always tell when it was her cynicism or when she was really meaning what she was saying.
Well, I found that it takes me two or three readings to be sure of that on some of these. Yeah. She would not be very popular with the status quo, you know, with the government, with power brokers, because so much of what she says and says is highly unusual, yet commonplace. Details are embarrassing to those of us in charge of things. And as you say, this is true in almost every place in the world. So if we think, well, what does a Polish woman have to say to me? This collection, her work, makes it clear that she has a lot to say to us. And so did the Nobel Prize Committee. Yes?
I'm not sure I see so much cynicism, maybe a kind of sarcasm. I mean, if the poem about lovers, if I got that tied to a chair and beat it properly, I thought it was saying that the reason we don't really believe that stuff, or most of the world who doesn't believe that stuff, doesn't because it's too hard to live that way. It's too hard to live really being in love.
Is it the true love?
That's right. It's much easier to live a life where you don't suffer the pain of what true lovers have to live with. And it's sort of like if you use that as a window on all the rest of them, it's like to use someone else's phrase, we tranquilize ourselves with the trivial because it's just kind of too painful to do the other thing.
Yeah.
You know, to be attached to beauty and love and life.
Now, do you hear in that poem, in which she says there's so little true love anyways, there's not enough to populate the world and so forth, and why don't they be quiet and all their little lovey rituals, bother the rest of us, leave us alone so we don't have to go around thinking that happens very much in the world at all. That's the way it seems to me. Is that missing your point?
No. But I see that as mildly sarcastic. Just let us alone. Let us live our dull life. Because it's easier. It's just easier to live. Go be in love somewhere else. We don't want to see it.
Well, perhaps she's making fun, using sarcasm, and many cultural images of seeking out true love, finding it, living happily ever after, and that is an image that gets projected to us visually, verbally, auditorily, over and over again every day, and saying that's going to lead us astray.
Could you read it one more time?
Sure. I can. True love. True love, is it normal? Is it serious? Is it practical? What does the world get from two people who exist in a world of their own? Placed on the same pedestal for no good reason, drawn randomly from millions, but convinced that it had to happen this way. So we were predestined. In reward for what? For nothing. The light descends from nowhere. Why on these two and not on others? Doesn't this outrage justice? Yes, it does. Now here's where we have to start sensing the tone of voice. What's her rhetorical answer to that rhetorical question? Doesn't it disrupt our painstakingly erected principles and cast the moral from the peak? Yes, on both accounts. Look at the happy couple. Couldn't they at least try to hide it? Fake a little depression for their friends' sake? Listen to them laughing. It's an insult. The language they use, deceptively clear. And their little celebrations, rituals, the elaborate mutual routines, it's obviously a plot behind the human race's back. Pretty cynical about those people or about the circumstances that lead to this kind of couple. It's hard even to guess how far things might go if people start to follow their example. What could religious and poetry count on? What would be remembered? What renounced? Who'd want to stay within the bounds? True love. Is it really necessary? Tact and common sense tell us to pass over it in silence, like a scandal in life's highest circles. Perfectly good children are born without its help. It couldn't populate the planet in a million years. It comes along so rarely. Let the people who never find true love keep saying that there's no such thing. Their faith will make it easier for them to live and die. And you know, I think you've sensed that one way to survive life and its many disappointments, its brokenness, is not to put so much faith in true love and that it's going to happen to me and so forth. We'd all be better off, this cynical voice is saying, if we just shut up about true love and ignored it, bury ourselves in something else.
To me, that's extremely spiritual, in a sense of the true love being God love.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't accept that because we don't know it. And it so seldom really happens that we make these pretend things or that we walk away.
Did others of you see the true love as being the love of God toward us?
It kind of toward the end there moves into this, you know, what would religions and poetry have to offer? You know, that there weren't brokenness in the world, if things really did have that quality of unconditional love that just pervaded, there wouldn't be all of this history, there's nothing to recall or remember. She does that too. There's a Naomi Nye poem it makes me think of called So Much Happiness at that point, where she says that really it's easier if you have a wound to tend, if you have brokenness, that sort of gives us something to do, but that so much happiness floats in a way that world be a confusing upside down place.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely for me an image, so that upside downness of God's love.
Okay.
Early on she talked about the light shining on us too.
Yeah.
And that really kind of brought that spiritual aspect in for me from that and even before that.
Yeah. Although she did say coming out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And maybe.
But nowhere.
But maybe, maybe that's just her way of saying it's transcendent and divine. Yeah.
Well, it's odd that she doesn't deny its existence. I mean, she's very clear about that at the end, that it really is there. And the
true love.
And that say it's not are doing it as a kind of lie to make their own lives bearable. So I think if you admit that it's real, and it's sort of like, I don't know, it's a little like that last poem that you read where, you know, you can't explain, you know, certain things in the world, but that doesn't mean they don't exist, and so you just have to sort of make your peace with them. But my question is it a love poem? I mean, is this really one of these very devious, I mean, is she potentially speaking as a lover and trying to put herself outside that picture that what the rest of the world sees?
I perhaps shouldn't have called it a love poem, but rather a poem about love, rather than an expression of love from one person to another.
But I'm curious about that. In some ways, I sort of think it might be a very clever love poem. What must it look like to the rest of the world?
Yeah.
Love.
That we've got this. And they don't. Yeah.
We came in a little late, but I'm curious about the context. Is she just a crappy old woman, or is she experienced some joy in her life? Is she a person of wealth? Did she move from poverty to wealth?
She did move from poverty. Don't know how much wealth. As I explained at the very outset, I've never done research about her. You know, I've not been a student or scholar and worked looking into these things. But the little bit I know about her, which is just, you know, thumbnail bibliography, back of the book jacket kind of information, is that she was born poor in Poland, and then when World War II came around, you know, she was one of those who had to keep on the move. And then finally she did marry and was very political, I gather. But as far as I know, no great wealth. Who was it who?
It was Rebecca, I think, who said she doesn't want much to do with the pomp and circumstance of the Nobel Prize. She doesn't necessarily want or expect to be recognized, lives on an ordinary little street in her town.
Yeah.
Hasn't changed anything about her life.
Yeah, and Rebecca had a student who lived in the
who
neighborhood.
Lived in that town. Yeah.
And said, she's just a lady down the street.
Just a lady down the street.
Well, it's 7:15. Thanks very much for coming.